I know I'm not the only Native American in a STEM field, but, you know, we're not very visible.
An Alaskan will bring her cause to Washington during the President's State of the Union speech. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, January 11th. Good evening. I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Dillingham police bust an alleged heroin dealer.
Mr. Rivera is what you could refer to as a commercial heroin dealer, a man who comes to our region from out of town to make money.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Artists make us think and question. They excite and engage. Artists inspire Alaska. The 2016 Rasmussen Foundation Individual Artist Awards Grant Program is now accepting applications. Individual Artist Awards support Alaska artists in 10 creative disciplines at all career stages. The program is open to Alaska residents only. For details and to apply, visit rasmussen.org/IAA. The deadline is March 1st, 2016. This message sponsored by the Rasmussen Foundation.
Representative Sam Keto III wants to repeal the ballot measure that cut the Alaska legislature's annual session from 120 days to 90. Here's the Juneau Democrats' pitch.
My issue with the 90-day session is while we're trying to be efficient with state funding, I think we are losing opportunities to have adequate time to consider legislation or to consider impacts to the budget. And I think we can, in 120 days, accomplish a lot of work and potentially decrease the need for as many special sessions as we've been having recently.
Keto says it would increase staff and per diem costs, but thinks that may be offset by savings from holding fewer special sessions and other efficiencies. An official cost estimate is in the works. So far, Keto says he's gotten mixed feedback from his colleagues.
Well, I want to have the discussion, and there may be some challenges, especially with the fiscal discussion taking place at the same time in getting the bill passed in a single session, but there are many pieces of legislation that take more than a single session to pass. It's important for me, I think, given the fiscal climate, to start having this discussion and for me to be able to demonstrate that it actually can result in more efficient legislation or more efficient process.
Keto's House Bill 223 is the fourth legislative attempt to change the 90-day session since 2006, when Alaska voters narrowly passed the ballot measure. In 2011, three Republican lawmakers sponsored separate legislation to extend the session. Then Senate President Gary Stevens' SB 18 made it the furthest. It tried to add 30 days to the second session of the legislature's two-year cycle. The Senate passed it 12-5, but it died in the House Finance Committee along with Representative Paul Seaton's HB 71, a straight repeal. As co-chair of the House Finance Committee, Bill Stoltz was the gatekeeper that kept the bills from advancing. Stoltz is now in the Senate. The legislature's lawyers have said it is unlikely breaking the 90-day statute has any legal consequence because it's still trumped by the 120-day rule in the Constitution. Lawmakers have tried to respect voters' intent, but have also run over the 90-day limit and held frequent special sessions for extra time. President Obama will give his final State of the Union address tomorrow night in Congress. A 24-year-old Alaska Native woman named Lydia Doza will be among the guests sitting in the First Lady's gallery. But as APRN's Liz Ruskin reports, Doza nearly passed up the invitation.
Doza studies software engineering at Oregon Tech. She says she got a call recently but didn't answer because she was in class.
And then I received a text message saying that it was someone from the White House, and they left me a return phone number. And I almost didn't call back because I thought it was a scam of some sort.
Doza says she remained doubtful, but did return the call.
Even if it was, you know, fake, then I could just, like, hang up.
But it was real. The White House was calling with an invitation to come to Washington for the State of the Union. Doza, a graduate of Diamond High in Anchorage, was recognized for her work with Native American youth.
I encourage students to go into higher education, especially in the STEM fields.
That's STEM, Science, Technology, Engineering, and Math. Doza is a Sea Alaska shareholder of Tsimshian, Haida, and Inupiat heritage. It was robots that first attracted her to engineering, specifically her work on her high school robotics team. But she says a lot of Native kids don't see scientists and engineers who look like them.
I think that's a big problem, you know, because I know I'm not the only Native American in a STEM field, but it's just, you know, we're not very visible.
Doza says if children don't have family members or no other adults in that line of work, it may not occur to them to pursue it for themselves.
That's kind of why I want to be a spokesperson and why I work with the community so much, just to be a presence in their lives.
Doza will be among 24 presidential guests at the speech. They include a Syrian refugee, a female graduate of Army Ranger School, a 12-year-old hunger activist, and the CEO of Microsoft. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
The giant, persistent mass of warm ocean water known as the blob seems to have cooled over the past few months, possibly because of another warm ocean phenomenon that is now dominating the Pacific. KTOO's Matt Miller has more from Juneau.
Measurements of Northeast Pacific sea surface temperatures suggest that an unusual mass of warm water either diminished dramatically or even started dissipating during November.
It's an evolving system.
Nicholas Bond, a senior scientist at NOAA's Joint Institute for the Study of Atmosphere and Ocean at the University of Washington, identified the increasing sea surface temperatures starting in October of 2013. Bond was the one who coined the nickname, the blob, in a monthly letter in his other role as Washington State climatologist.
We can see the beginning of the end for the blob, but by some measures, it's still got kind of its ugly head is still rearing.
At its peak, the blob generated ocean surface temperatures that were 2 to 3 degrees Celsius above average. Now, temperatures are only 0.5 to 1.5 degrees above average.
It has moderated to an extent, and whether it's gone or still there is kind of a matter of taste, but it is warm enough there relative to normal that it's probably having an impact on the weather, especially in places right along the coast.
Temperatures are still slightly above normal near shore, but far offshore in the middle of the Northeast Pacific, temperatures have significantly cooled to near normal in some areas.
The big amplitude of warm water, that's gone, and there's no reason to expect that to reform at all.
Cliff Moss claims the blob is dead. Moss is a professor of atmospheric sciences and one of Bond's colleagues at the University of Washington. He says persistent high pressure over the Northeast Pacific, earlier moderated winds near the ocean surface.
Which means there's less mixing in the upper ocean, which brings up less cold water from below.
But Moss says that high pressure hasn't been as persistent lately, and more cold water is now being stirred up from below.
It's really changed, and that's because of El Niño. The El Niño circulation works against the blob, and that's progressively happening now.
El Niño, which is associated with equatorial ocean warming, is going gangbusters, and that, Moss writes in his blog, should be good news for Pacific Northwest ski areas. Nicholas Bond believes the ocean is still retaining enough heat energy for the blob to persist for at least several more months, and it could actually be reinforced by El Niño near shore. Aside from affecting weather patterns and prompting precipitation changes, the higher sea surface temperatures may also be responsible for the recent appearance of unusual species in the Northeast Pacific, like sunfish and tuna. But Bond says those are anecdotal accounts of stragglers getting swept up north. What's more important is what's happening at the base of the food chain. He says there's still more warm water plankton than cold water plankton.
That's actually a big deal because those cold water species are bigger and have more fat in them, and so more calories for the small fish and the juvenile salmon and so forth that feed on them. And so that kind of transition that we've seen over the last year or so is kind of still going on, and it is having impacts on the whole marine food web.
Bond says juvenile salmon and seabirds may be doing poorly along the West Coast, while tuna could benefit from the increased temperatures. Scientists from a variety of fields will converge on Seattle in late January for another conference on recent changes and impacts of the blob. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Matt Miller.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the Rasmussen Foundation funds a big expansion at the museum.
We all regret that people will come and visit and not have a chance to experience those treasures of Alaska.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Alaskan lives are salmon lives. Every Alaskan is connected to salmon, whether living in downtown Anchorage or on the Yukon River. So this winter, join the Salmon Project as they journey across the state. Join the journey at salmonlife.org. This message sponsored by the Salmon Project.
Fairbanks City Council member David Pruse is sponsoring an ordinance that would ban marijuana clubs. Clubs, which do not sell the drug but provide paying members a venue for its consumption, are not currently covered by state regulations, but the State Marijuana Control Board is looking at requiring them to be licensed like cannabis retailers. Councilmember Pruse says his ordinance would allow for clubs licensed as part of retail operations.
We'll be amending the city code for public use for that. So anyone who has a marijuana club or wants to have a marijuana club in the city of Fairbanks, go out and get a retail license and add it to your marijuana club.
Pruse says retail license status would put clubs under the same regulations as other marijuana businesses, including local zoning. Fairbanks' only marijuana club, The Higher Calling, is across the street from a downtown daycare, a location that would violate borough zoning if it were a retail operation. The club's owners have said they're considering relocation and will get a license if required to. The city's marijuana club prohibition ordinance is being introduced at tonight's Fairbanks City Council meeting. And in Anchorage, two separate items coming before the assembly will shape the state's largest market for commercial cannabis for years to come. Industry groups are worried it'll be for the worse. On Tuesday, the assembly will get its first glimpse of the ordinance that will determine where marijuana businesses can operate around Anchorage. Municipal Attorney Bill Falsey says the initial proposal came from the mayor's office and recommendations were added by the Planning and Zoning Commission.
The question is, what does this ordinance do? In brief, it would govern which zones a marijuana establishment could be located in. It would also address how far a marijuana establishment would have to be separated from certain other uses like schools and parks.
The current recommendations don't endorse an option for businesses in residential areas, a model compared to the popular Fire Island Bakery. Instead, Falsey says the zoning map only makes licenses available in certain non-residential parts of town.
The emphasis is on commercial and industrial areas of town.
The other issue before the assembly is a potential sales tax of 5% on cannabis products. If approved by the body Tuesday night, the tax proposal will go before voters on the April ballot. The measure's sponsors say the tax is necessary to cover local costs for enforcing regulations and gives the assembly the ability to raise or lower the tax by 2% every other year. But Bruce Schulte, an industry advocate who sits on the state's Marijuana Control Board, says that while a tax is reasonable, the logic behind the current version is not. State regulators are tasked with monitoring compliance among new marijuana businesses. And Schulte says it's an assumption of bad faith among Anchorage lawmakers that there will be abundant rule breaking demanding more enforcement.
What we're seeing is this sort of knee-jerk reaction where people, they're just assuming that this industry is bad and awful and nobody wants it next door. And they're honestly regulating it more like, you know, toxic waste dumps than what they really are.
Schulte has worked with the Anchorage Assembly for months preparing regulations, but he's recently grown frustrated by mistrust and lack of information among elected officials as they craft laws. Schulte says the growing layers of regulation are unnecessarily burdensome and hurt the industry's chances of becoming a viable alternative to the black market.
Anchorage seems to be doing everything they possibly can to kill it before it gets started.
The assembly will take public testimony on the tax proposal ahead of its vote on Tuesday evening. Over the weekend, the Dillingham Police Department seized 12.5 grams of heroin and $19,000 while searching a home in one of the town's main neighborhoods. The bust came after about a week-long investigation. The alleged dealer is a 37-year-old from Anchorage who's now being held on $50,000 bail. KDLG's Dave Benninger has more.
After he flew into town recently, 37-year-old Joshua Rivera from the Anchorage area set up shop at the home of Leroy Walona Jr. at 1845 Nurka Loop. From there, specifically in the upstairs left bedroom, Rivera served his customers from a couple of large chunks of black tar heroin, which were hidden in makeup and jewelry cases. He sliced off doses and weighed them on a scale, a tiny tenth of a gram going for $100. How much Rivera sold during his time in Dillingham may not be known, but by the time DPD searched the house Saturday night, he had more than $19,000 in cash. Neighbors like Priscilla Dre say they were not entirely surprised to hear about the bust.
I live right across the street. There was a lot of traffic coming, especially when it's getting dark, so I would lock my doors and close the curtains.
A few neighbors did quietly call the police with their suspicions. The department already had its eye on Rivera. Chief Dan Pasquarello, a veteran of the cat-and-mouse game of drug trafficking in town, has his officers patrol the airport frequently, watching for arrivals and departures of suspected dealers in from Anchorage. These are people who show up in town for a few days, lay low at a house, often of a known user or lower-level dealer, and fly back. Police know these individuals aren't coming to town for a basketball game or to cross-country ski. They're here to turn a serious profit.
In the drug milieu, Dillingham has a lot of subsistence heroin dealers. These are local people that sell small amounts of heroin on a sporadic basis to support their drug habit. Mr. Rivera is what you could refer to as a commercial heroin dealer, a man who comes to our region from out of town to make money.
To extend that fishing metaphor, Pasquarello likens the way DPD investigates and eventually busts these dealers to setting a net.
We receive information all the time from members of the public and also from people involved with the heroin problem here in Dillingham. And when everything comes together, we set out a net to try to catch dealers. We don't just pull in our net as soon as we see a splash in it, because then you only catch one dealer. Lots of times we like to let the net soak, catch more dealers.
In this case, Pasquarello says they would have liked to keep their net out a little longer and see if they might wrap up whoever is supplying Rivera. But they were pretty sure he was about to leave town and decided to move in before they lost a chance to nab him with the goods. Rivera was booked on two charges of second-degree misconduct involving a controlled substance. Magistrate Judge Tina Ray ordered him held on $50,000, double what the state had asked, and he'll need a third-party custodian to be released. Rivera has a lengthy criminal record, including past charges for drugs, theft, and escape from custody. He was on parole in a felony DUI case, and on account of that, isn't likely to get released even if he does make bail. In Dillingham, I'm Dave Benninger.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
the 2016 statewide BP Teachers of Excellence program. Teacher nomination forms are available at bpteachers.com. Alaska's tobacco quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their home. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins lead to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
The Anchorage Museum is getting a big financial boost from the Rasmussen Foundation and the Rasmussen family for an expansion, a gift of $24 million. $12 million from the foundation will be matched by the Rasmussen family. Diane Kaplan is the president and CEO of the Rasmussen Foundation. She says it's the largest gift the Rasmussen Foundation has ever given, and the idea is to help the museum offer more space for temporary and permanent exhibits.
There's a lot of art that the public would be interested in seeing in storage, and a lot of it will get to be available for people to experience going forward.
The expansion will feature a large space devoted to Sidney Lawrence, Eustace Sigler, and other Alaska masters. Why is this an important addition to the museum?
That area that's been in the museum for many, many years is one of the most popular here, but because of the demand for temporary exhibits and special exhibits, it's not always available to the public. So right now, for example, those paintings are not available, and I think we all regret that people will come and visit, and locals here, people from around the state, and not have a chance to experience those treasures of Alaska. So this will make it possible for those to always be on exhibit.
Elmer and Mary Louise Rasmussen were instrumental in the creation of the museum. What was it about that? Why did they believe the museum was so important to Anchorage and Alaska?
When Elmer was the mayor of Anchorage, he initiated the effort to have a museum, and he really believed that any great city had to have a great museum. So he took it upon himself to get the assembly to set aside a block in downtown for a museum, and then he and Mary Louise hosted the first fundraising event in 1966. And I understand it was a pretty interesting meeting where he sat at the head of the table with some of his friends and took out his checkbook and said, "I'm writing a check, and would you please all take your checkbooks out? I expect you to write one too." So that's how it started, and the first museum opened on the site in 1968. Mary Louise served as head of the museum commission, and this was a favorite one of the many, many, many things they supported in Alaska over the years.
There's such a lot of focus right now on the current budget crisis that it seems that this makes this large gift of particular note. Are you worried the museum is building something that the future economy of the state and city won't be able to maintain, or is this sort of a statement about the faith going forward?
I do think it's reminder that we have to continue to invest in making Anchorage a great city and one that has qualities that attracts people, that attracts businesses. The expansion is going to be 100% privately funded, but instead of building, for example, a separate kind of wing that would have very significant operating expenses attached to it, the decision was made to take advantage of the facility we have and grow it. And there's been a very thorough business plan constructed, and we're confident that with the growing membership of the museum, the growing donations to the museum, the growing participation and visitorship, that this will be very supportable going forward.
Diane Kaplan is the president and CEO of the Rasmussen Foundation. Museum Director Julie Decker says the expansion will largely be a vertical addition.
What we are doing is building on top of the remaining, the only one-story section of the building that's left, and we're building a second story on top of that. So if you went down the museum on 6th Avenue and before you got to A Street, you would see a brick portion of the building from the original 1968 structure, and we're building a second story there.
Decker says with the current economic worries in the state, local construction projects are an important positive message about the future.
I think what people want to see at all times to know the economy is healthy and future-oriented is to see growth. And so from a construction point of view and for other trades, I think it's an important time to be having a high profile and a significant project going up.
The expansion will be funded entirely with private money. This weekend's Copper Basin 300 sled dog race saw the first musher cross the finish line before 10 a.m. today. Good weather and a fast trail contributed to an early finish for this year's race. KCHU's Marsha Lynn has more.
Musher Matt Hall and his team crossed the finish line at Old Path Baptist Church in Glen Allen at 9:43 Monday morning.
Matt Hall has been a very competitive racer, and I think he finished in the top eight last year. So maybe this is just his year to shine, huh?
This is Meg Jensen, Copper Basin 300 board president, speaking from the finish line.
I guess it was a pretty fast track and, boy, very competitive race. We were wondering until the very end who was going to be the front runner.
Third place finisher Alan Moore crossed the finish line at 10:24 a.m. Monday, followed by fourth place finisher Allie Zirkel, who crossed the line at 10:28 Monday morning. In an interview with KCAM Radio in Glen Allen, second place finisher Ryan Olson, who came in at 10 a.m. sharp Monday, says trail conditions helped the racers speed along.
It was a great trail, really hard-packed and fast. There was 20 less miles of it, but no, it was a great trail. It was perfect. There was no open water, no wet overflow, well, minimal.
Rain around the holidays caused very icy trail conditions, and for safety reasons, the board chose to move this year's race start 20 miles north of Glen Allen to the Gakona Lodge, about a mile off the Richardson Highway on the Toke Cutoff. In that same KACM interview, race manager Eric Lutz gives kudos to the weather.
You know, as much as bad luck we've had with the weather, we also had great luck for the weather, which sounds weird to say that for this race. It's been just cold enough and just warm enough at the same time.
Mushers have a required layover at Mendeltna Lodge on the Glen Highway, the last checkpoint before the finish line. Lutz was there Sunday night and says they didn't really stop to chill.
There's no slacking around. Like, when they're checking out, their hand is barely touching the door as long as they can see, and then as soon as you give them the go, and they're literally running and disappearing as fast as they can.
The Copper Basin 300 is an all-volunteer manned race. And Jensen says this year's race has been a smooth production from start to finish.
Mushers have been really positive about the trail and the checkpoints and the setup and how it's all worked this year.
Mushers and their teams will continue to trickle into Glen Allen through Tuesday. Jensen says with the extra speed, there's a good chance they will all cross the finish line before Tuesday night's awards banquet. In Valdez, I'm Marcia Lynn.
Former Anchorage Archbishop Francis Hurley has died at age 88. The Archdiocese of Anchorage says Hurley died at his Anchorage home Sunday evening, 2 days before his 89th birthday. Anchorage funeral arrangements are pending. Hurley moved to Alaska in 1970 when he was appointed auxiliary bishop of the Juneau Diocese. He was appointed as Archbishop of Anchorage in 1976, retiring from that role in 2001. In 2010, the long-retired Hurley presided over the funeral of former Alaska Governor Walter Hickel. Several months later, he presided over the funeral of former U.S. Senator Ted Stevens, who died in a plane crash. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can find us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Jeremy Shea and Matt Miller in Juneau, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Dave Benninger in Juneau in Dillingham, and Marcia Lynn in Valdez. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Monica Goki is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Raven Alaska, offering passenger, cargo, and same-day package delivery to over 100 communities across Alaska. Find more at flyraven.com.
It's as easy as 1, 2, 3. 1, file your 2016 PFD application today. 2, receive a confirmation of filing. And 3, sign electronically with your secure My Alaska account. Visit pfd.alaska.gov for more information. And remember, the deadline to apply is Thursday, March 31st. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska. Alaska Pacific University delivers an affordable education and life-friendly schedules designed to support your personal and professional goals. Graduate with work-ready experience in the career field of your choice. Apply now for fall 2016 and find out more about APU's Promise Tuition Grant and other scholarships at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by APU.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.